5 Live Drive.
Tony Livesey and Claire McDonald.
Thank you for joining us. We are talking all things neurodiversity this week. It's part of 5 Lives Me, My Health and I series, and we're also marking Neurodiversity Celebration Week as well. Now, neurodiversity, it's a word that champions people who are autistic, dyslexic, dyspraxic and have ADHD as well as other conditions as well. And around 1 in 5 people identify as neurodivergent. It's a really high ratio. Awareness has been growing in recent years thanks to some high-profile people talking about their personal situations. The BBC series Inside Our Autistic Minds, presented by Chris Packham, is one such example. Now, since coming out last year, it won multiple TV awards and has just been recommissioned for a second series. The new series is going to be focusing on those who are ADHD or dyslexic. Delighted to say Chris Packham joins us now alongside journalist Nick Ransom, who was an assistant producer on the series, and Nick also has autism. Welcome, both of you.
Hello. Thanks for having us.
It's great to have you here. Chris, first of all, let's start with you. I mean, the reaction to your programme was quite something, wasn't it, from the general public? And, you know, it won loads of awards. What did that mean to you personally?
Well, what means most to me personally, that we've managed to improve the lives, so I'm told by that general public, who have been so positive in their responses to the programme, for themselves and for autistic people that they know, live with, work with, maybe their children or colleagues. And what they've repeatedly said, which is joyous to hear, is that it opened their eyes to what living with the condition was like through the bravery and candid nature of our 4 contributors who spoke so frankly about what it was like living with autism. And it really gave people an insight into how it impacts upon their lives, both negatively and positively. And the fact that the programme is now being used by healthcare professionals and so forth is really, really good news. A great piece of public service broadcasting. Hats off to Nick and the team, and of course the BBC.
Yeah, Nick, let's bring you in here. When did you first find out that you were autistic?
Yeah, it was about the age of 20, actually. So I was studying at university here in Salford, and yeah, always knew that I wanted to be in the sort of TV media space. But yeah, it was something that I was just so obsessive about. And then, yeah, I was kind of always a bit of an annoyance at home, shall we say, for my parents. And yeah, it got towards the end of my teenage years, and they thought, he's still not quite, I don't know, it's not teenage behaviour anymore, I guess. And it got to a point where, yeah, they said, oh, you might be autistic. And yeah, it was just small things, like if, you know, dinner was late, or, you know, something broke, or, you know, things didn't go to plan, or holidays were always quite tricky. And then, yeah, I kind of was quite ambitious in the fact that I didn't know I was autistic. And actually, I think if I had been diagnosed really young, I might not have come up all the way to Salford here. And so, yeah, but I mean, obviously an honour to work with Chris and work on, yeah, Inside Autism.
Well, I mean, was school tricky for you?
Yeah, I mean, to some degree. I mean, I was picked on a little bit at school. But yeah, academically was kind of always fine, really. And it's the kind of classic masking thing, really, that we you know, looked at in our programme, really, where actually you can sort of put a front on for most of the day. And then by the time you get home, all that sort of energy comes out in, I guess, the wrong way, really. So yeah, I guess I just used, you know, I did a lot of YouTube work. I did a lot of filming in my local community, volunteering, and just kind of put all my efforts into trying to get into the media.
Well, and you look at you now, award-winning documentary maker, absolutely brilliant. Chris, for you, you always thought you had very low self-esteem, I read, that because you were autistic but didn't understand what that was.
Yeah, I grew up obviously much older than Nick. I grew up in the 60s and 70s, where there was no way for my parents or those that were educating me to understand anything about the condition. It wasn't widely known. I did okay as a child, but by the time I got to my teens and 20s, I struggled with people of my own age, and I felt bullied and excluded, and my self-esteem hit rock bottom, which led to mental health difficulties, of course. I felt that I was broken. I didn't understand, you know, that I was simply different. I contrasted myself with the vast majority of other people, and they seemed to be normal, and I seemed to be broken. So I wasn't a great fan of Chris Packham, not something I've ever recovered from, to be quite honest with you. But knowing how the condition impacts upon your life, learning about that does give you the capacity to develop management techniques. Nick's talked about that, the way that he did a bit of masking, but he battled on, focused on things, very determined, very obsessed, which are characteristic traits of people like myself and Nick. And we tend to try and bruise through these things. Of course, it's much easier if you get support from your friends and family, or, of course, from the health service too. And that's, again, what was at the core of our programme. We were trying to say to people, look, sometimes it's just the tiniest things that you need to change, accept and understand about autistic people, make little changes in their lives, and that can vastly improve the likelihood of positive outcomes.
You found a piece of A4 paper that you'd written a phrase on repeatedly when you were younger. Well, what did you write on that piece of paper?
Everything I am is wrong. And I wrote it as if it was lines I'd been given earlier at school, but I was much older at that point. I think that's more of a reflection of my poor mental health and inability to understand why I was different. And with the benefit of hindsight, going back to the mid-70s, when, you know, if it had been appropriate for me or possible for me to get a diagnosis, I'm sure it would have been enormously helpful, because then at least I would have had some semblance of an understanding about what it was about myself, what was different with other, from other people. And I might have been a lot, it might have been a lot easier to accept. But I think we've got to say that even in today's world, where we have moved on considerably, getting a diagnosis is not the end of the story. That support that needs to follow from family, from guardians, from educators and so on and so forth needs to be there. Otherwise, you are simply a young person wandering around with a T-shirt that says autistic on it. And unless other people can understand that and offer you the support that you need to reduce your anxiety and offer you opportunities to develop a more positive, proactively progressive life, then the problem isn't solved.
Nick, what needs to change? I mean, you've just did a brilliant job through the first series, shining a light on individual stories. But as a society, we're having the conversation now. It's up and running. That's brilliant. But as Chris said, people need practical help, don't they? And we need to be, a lot more understanding as a society in schools, in the workplace, in social situations. What needs to change?
Yeah, there's a few things, really. I mean, I think a mixture of it is obviously people understanding and getting an insight into autistic experiences. Actually, I think one strength of the programme was actually that we saw a range of autistic experiences. I'm very conscious that Chris and I are two white men, and actually that's so much broader than that. We focused on women. There was, ethnic diversity in the programme. But also, I think one thing is also speaking more positively. And in the programme, you see the strengths of autistic people. And often we do talk about it in a very sort of medicalised way, where we go, it's a disaster, which, obviously I'm not here to kind of say that there aren't challenges, but and we should obviously address them. But, neurodivergent people have such strength about them, as we see through Chris's campaigning and everything that he does. But we don't really talk about the strengths that autistic people have and neurodivergent people have. And so I think, I'm keen to see more of that in the media. That's kind of what I do in my role now as a sort of neurodiversity journalist. And so we're doing things with the BBC Sport website this week, lots going on there. And so, I think it is, as I say, trying to be a bit more balanced in our representation.
Chris, let's look at the positives then. What are they? What should we be focusing on? Because, as we've just heard there, outlined by Nick, it's very, very often seen as something that is lacking rather than something that's adding into society.
Yeah, well, Nick's absolutely right. There are enabling aspects of the condition and disabling aspects of the condition. We can't forget those disabling things. When it comes to those, I think we need to, ask people to think about what triggers them. If you are the parents of an autistic child, look very carefully at what, instigates the periods of discomfort and anxiety. But equally, look very carefully at what enhances that young person's ability to have a better quality of life. And that can be often very simple things about allowing them their own space, allowing them to run a timetable, essentially allowing them to take control of their environment, whether it's physical, temporal or emotional. From my point of view, some of my sensory capabilities seem to be more enhanced than some people. As a naturalist, that's an asset. I see things in great detail very quickly. Again, a tremendous asset as a naturalist slash scientist in a former life. And then I have a very good memory, and that's a characteristic trait of people with autism too. All of those things come together to mean that when I'm making a program like Swing Watch, if something comes up, I don't need to reach for the book. I can remember it, and I can remember a tremendous amount very quickly. So I can't deny that that is an asset which has allowed me to progress in some way in my career. On the other side, I have to work in a team. It's a social situation. We need to maximize our and optimize our output when we're making Spring Watch. So therefore, I'm working with a large number of other people. I have to manage myself. I have to make sure that I'm, you know, I segue into that so that we can all be productive. I'm very fortunate. I work with a tremendously accepting and understanding team of people there across the board, actually, of diversity, which is great. And that's what we need to be seeing spreading out into other institutions beyond the BBC, into business, into education, and so on and so forth.
Well, you've done such a fantastic job on this. And we're going to see, aren't we, Chris, a second series. It's going to focus on ADHD and dyslexia as well. So what are you hoping to kind of get across to the general public? What stories are you hoping to find?
Well, as Nick and I have been saying, we think that we've made, you know, significant advances in terms of communicating to people, not just within the body of our programme, but generally about what autism is. And people's wider understanding of that is making autistic people's lives better. We've still got some way to go. But there are misconceptions that surround ADHD and dyslexia, which I think remain more deeply entrenched in societies. People still think of the stereotypes. I mean, cast your mind back to the 1980s. If we were speaking about autism then, it was Dustin Hoffman in Rain Man. It was savantism like that. And that's the way people imagined it. I think when it comes to ADHD and dyslexia, there was still a lot of misconceptions. The fact that dyslexia is still thought of in some circles as word blindness. People have difficulty reading and writing, which they may have, but it's far more far-reaching than that. And when it comes to ADHD, the typical stereotypical view of that condition is a hyperactive young male. And yet we know that many women are being diagnosed in later in life with a form of HD, which is very, very different indeed. So the aim of our programme, rather like the first, is to work with people who are going to find the confidence to act as ambassadors for those conditions, speak candidly about it with the support of their friends and families, colleagues, etc., to give everyone a greater insight into how those conditions impact upon people's lives and how the simplest changes can make those lives so much more fulfilling and so much better.
As you said, so perfectly at the start of this, you both fulfilled an incredible public service. So we thank you so much for that and really looking forward to seeing what you do with the next series. Chris Packham, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And journalist Nick Ransom, assistant producer on the first series. Thanks
thank
for coming
very much.
By, Nick.
Thanks.
Five Live Drive.
Good evening. It's Five Live Drive. It's Tony and Fliss. The whole of this week on Five Live, we've been talking all things neurodiversity. And it's part of Five Lives' Me, My Health and I series. Charities, organisations and the neurodivergent community are also marking Neurodiversity Celebration Week. That's this week. And tonight, an organisation called Neurodiverse Sport are hosting their first event in London. And it's where a panel of sports stars will be quizzed by autistic journalist Nick Ransom. And we're lucky enough to be able to speak to Nick now. Nick, good evening.
Hi there, good evening. How are you doing?
How's it shaping up?
Yeah, it's getting really exciting here. We've got all the chairs and tables laid out. The sun has set over the Tower Bridge here, where we're just next to the Thames, overlooking the Tower of London, opposite the Tower of London. So, yeah, the room is starting to fill up. And in case you've not been listening this week, neurodiversity, diversity of thought, you know, one in five people are autistic and dyslexic, or dyslexic, dyspraxic, ADHD or neurodivergent in another way. And yeah, it's an area that sport is looking at with greater and greater interest. And yeah, we're expecting a number of sports stars here tonight as well. So yeah, it's going to be a great night.
Fantastic.
And so I'm joined now by founder of Neurodiverse Sport that you mentioned there, Fliss, Cara McMurtry, who is leading the event tonight. She's a former Olympic rower and was diagnosed as autistic at the end of her career. Evening, Cara. Good to see you.
Hi, Nick.
Tell us a little bit about tonight's event then and who's on the panel.
Yeah, so tonight's event is really about putting neurodiversity in sport as a topic on the map. So we've got some, I guess, movers and shakers in sport coming to watch. And then in terms of the panel, we've got a former Premier League footballer, Greg Halford, who is autistic. Samantha Smith, she is a former pro tennis player, current broadcaster, also recently divulged that she is autistic.
Friend of Five Live as well.
Yeah, she's actually known for a long time, but has kind of kept it to herself, I guess, through kind of fear of potential stigma. But, I mean, she can talk about that. We've got women's footballer, Brooke Hendricks. She has ADHD. And then we've got Matt Rogan, who is the founder of sports marketing company Two Circles, and he has two neurodivergent children who he's very passionate about. But yeah, like for me, I was very keen to like not have myself on the panel and to start having other voices, because I feel I've been really like leading like the, you know, banging of the drum for a while, and it's not about me, it's about all of those other people out there. So
yeah, no, and your story's on the BBC Sport website, which people could have a look at on the rowing page. Tell us a little bit about why you set up Neurodiverse Sport then on retiring.
Yeah, I guess it was very much in response to my experience of sport. So as you said, I was a late diagnosed autistic. In the middle of my career, I was misdiagnosed as having bipolar disorder. I was a very successful junior under 23 athlete, and I really struggled in a quite a centralised sort of rigid training system. You know, some people thrive in it. I didn't. I was, you know, neurodivergent and I didn't know it. And it wasn't until I got my diagnosis and understanding of myself and how to advocate for my own needs that I really was able to thrive. And then after that, I went to the Olympics. And it was really that kind of juxtaposition of those, you know, that really tough time and then feeling really empowered, that spurred me on to create Neurodiverse Sport, because I just knew I was not the only one. I could see it. I could see so many other athletes like me just kind of getting churned up and spat out. And yeah, Neurodiverse Sport is really here to advocate and to educate for neurodivergent people in sport.
Yeah, no, that's fantastic. And in terms of the conversations you've been having, I mean, you know, we've gone through that sort of mental health conversation, I guess. Is neurodiversity kind of on the back of that, I guess? As I mentioned, one in five are neurodivergent, and that's presumably a large proportion of the sporting community.
Yeah. I think yeah, it's definitely massively prevalent in sport. There's a limited amount of research out there at the moment, which hopefully is changing. But yeah, it's not... I would say it's different to mental health, but obviously the impact of kind of living and thinking in a way that is not congruent with your natural baseline can really have an impact on mental health, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And, I mean, what do you think needs to be done to better support neurodivergent athletes? Because I know you're having lots of conversations with organisations and various sporting bodies to try and do more in this area.
Yeah, I think it really, really starts with awareness and understanding. And then I think... flexibility of environments and allowing people to advocate for what they need. Like, everybody is different. That's the point of neurodiversity. It's not a one-size-fits-all solution, but it's also trying to steer away from the you know, having a norm or having a mold in sport, and just really embracing each individual and having coaches and managers who can be adaptive and innovative. So I think, yeah.
Yeah, well, fantastic. And good luck with the event tonight. It's been really great to chat to you.
Thank you. And I
should say that Greg Halford, who's on the panel here, he spoke to me last week for the BBC. His story is currently on the front page of the BBC Sport website. And as I mentioned, Cara's article is also on the rowing pages. So lots going on, and neurodiversity clearly becoming a bigger conversation in sport, Fliss.
It's really good to hear it sort of being discussed in sport, and not just among these kind of, you know, incredible athletes, but earlier on in the programme we were hearing from Darcy. She's 10 and she's going to this fantastic basketball club. She plays for a team that is kind of designed for neurodivergent people, and I was just wondering, you know, to get your perspective as someone who's autistic, whether that would have been something that you might have got something out of as a young person, or if you were enjoyed accessing just mainstream sports.
Yeah, a lot of young people, particularly if they're neurodivergent, do struggle with that element of being you know, in a sporting environment where perhaps people don't understand or know they're neurodivergent, and then there might be, you know, barriers in terms of, you know, too much lighting or sensory issues or that social challenge. So yeah, I mean, for me, I played a lot of football, but then sort of moved into the media world to kind of talk more about neurodiversity. But yeah, I was diagnosed aged 20, and I think it's something that, you know, we're hearing a lot more about, as say sports stars coming out, but particularly, you know, women are the big story in the sense of being diagnosed neurodivergent as later in life, and there's lots of conversations around that. So in terms of the sporting environment, you know, I've spoken to a lot of people and a lot of organizations that are keen to do better for not just elite athletes but grassroots, so it's clearly an area that we're going to be hearing a lot more about, I think.
And what about the event tonight? Like, who are you? You'll obviously be quizzing lots of different sports stars, so maybe I shouldn't ask you to tell me who you're most excited about speaking to, but it's going to be a good night.
Yeah, it is. And I think Sam Smith is going to be a really fascinating chat. I mean, I spoke to her last week about the event tonight. And, you know, as I mentioned, a big fan of big friend of Five Live, I should say, and has done lots of work in the tennis space, but hasn't felt comfortable to talk about being autistic. And she's now in a space where actually she feels comfortable and seeing the stuff that Cara is doing. So clearly feels that it's worth joining the club. And Greg Halford's story, which, as I say, on the BBC Sport website at the moment, he's very confident talking out about it now, which is a real step forward, I think, for the neurodivergent community. And yeah, is going to be working with Cara and trying to improve neurodiversity understanding. And it's clearly something, as I say, we're going to probably be revisiting on this programme.
No doubt. Nick, thank you. And I have young autistic people in my family, and I know that seeing sports stars kind of talking about this stuff will be just incredibly, incredibly inclusive, incredibly helpful. Nick, thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah,
have a fantastic night. That's our journalist. Thank you. Journalist Nick Ransom for us.
This is Five Live Sport.
Listen on BBC Sounds.
Great to have you with us this Sunday, Five Live Sport with me, Katie Smith. Over the past few days here across Five Live and BBC Sport, we've been sharing stories from sports people who are autistic, dyslexic, dyspraxic or have ADHD. Now, former Premier League defender Greg Halford has played for 20 different teams during his career. He was diagnosed as autistic while at Championship side Cardiff City in the 2017-18 season. And he's been talking to the BBC's Nick Ransom about his experience.
It all started with my son. He was diagnosed when he was 6 years old. It got me thinking I was exactly the same at that age. So I wanted to discover who I really was. 20 years ago, it wasn't really a thing. You were just classed as a naughty kid. It's a blessing in disguise that sort of everything's coming to the forefront now. I'm glad that it's happened, and I can only say thank you to my son for that.
Tell me about some of the challenges that you faced within the game, because I know you mentioned initiations and that sort of social side after training. Tell me, what were the most toughest parts of competing in football?
Moving around so much, meeting so many different people, being part of the change room and being part of that sort of over-masculinity arena. That was tough. Moving around so much at an early age, it taught me to learn a lot of stuff about myself, how to behave. The biggest challenge that comes with that is obviously the initiation that you mentioned. I tried it once, it didn't go to plan. You know, when you don't do that sort of thing, you have to pay a pretty heavy fine, monetary fine. That's what I ended up doing for the rest of the time. I didn't want to be one of them people that just came into a new club and dismissed the traditions of being part of the change room. But it was something that I felt that I had to do. They were probably a bit more standoffish at the beginning, but if they were given the opportunity to be able to get to know me as a person, which was rare because I was moving around so much, relationships developed. I was able to be more myself. You know, when obviously you are yourself, you're accepted more instead of trying to be something that you're not.
Just talk to me about the sort of stigma or environment and culture within a dressing room about talking about how you feel.
It doesn't happen. The only times you talk about your feelings is you're left out of a squad. But when it comes to personal feelings, it doesn't really happen, and not in change rooms anyway. Yeah, you may have a clique in the change room where there's three or four players where you may hang outside of the football walls, and you may go and have dinner or hang out at their homes, but I never really had that, so I couldn't talk on other people's situations.
Talk to me a little bit about that time at Cardiff and that moment where you actually felt comfortable to speak to the captain and the manager.
It was a relief. It was nice. It was nice that I was able to trust someone with that information, that personal information. I knew Neil would be fine with it. He wouldn't treat me any differently, and he didn't. It was a case of I'm me. And when it came to Sean, the captain, I felt comfortable because we'd been together nearly a year at that point. We spent a lot of time in and out of football, and he was the type of person that I could trust. And it was nice that I was able to finally open up about something that was so close to me, and there wouldn't be any consequences towards it.
That's former Premier League defender Greg Halford sharing his story for Neurodiversity Celebration Week. Nedim, some really interesting insight there into football dressing rooms, obviously a place that most of us aren't privy to, but the idea of inclusivity, and I just wondered your experiences and thoughts on that.
I really enjoyed listening to that, and I actually played football with Greg last summer for an AFC Wimbledon Foundation game. And the way that he talks, that was my first time meeting him, and that's the way that he was in that sort of dressing room as well. And I think the points that he's making, they're very, very good ones, because as you said there, Katie, nobody really knows about a football dressing room, but then there are lots of things within one which you probably don't want to know either. I think at times it can be a very, very hostile place, and I loved how open and honest he was about, say, when he got asked, so well, how often do you open up about that? And it's never. Because realistically, for people within that space, it's almost like you don't want to show vulnerability. And also, as you tell your tale, something that's really important to you, sometimes you feel you'd be telling it to people who don't care because they've got their own things going on. I think as time has passed, there have been more people that do care, but some of those people that care the most are the ones who you've kind of known the longest anyway, and you don't share all your information at the start. It takes a while. I think him mentioning Neil Warnock, I guess, and I think it was Sean Morrison, maybe, the centre-back, like, these are people that he knows, and he knows he can be open, honest, and they can understand. And because of the power that they have, they can dictate how he'll be treated within that space. But when you're a new player going somewhere, you don't have that. And I think for him, I feel bad for him, because those initiations, they're not for everyone, you know. I've seen some people really, like, just go within themselves and panic, like, have real anxiety about doing an initiation, which is, you know, part of football tradition, but it's not.
Well,
it's
and not even football.
Yeah,
is it? You know, we've
exactly.
All, well, I, yeah. I had to do one at university, Jules, you're nodding your head as well, and it can be a very...
It's not even a necessity. That's the thing, it's not a necessity, but we play it off as if it is. And I think from a footballing standpoint, if you decide to not do it immediately, people think, well, that's your personality trait. You don't want to be part of the group. You know, you think you're special, you think you're different. And those first few days, weeks, months, when people don't really know who you are, things like that carry you so much further than they need to. And I'm glad that he's speaking about it. I understand the importance of this week as well. And a football dressing room, obviously I'm not in one anymore, but at times it can be the best place, at times though it can be the worst place. And even in a team, you can suffer so much as an individual, which will affect your football, which makes things 10 times worse to begin with.
And I suppose moving around so much, as some players do, that can have a huge impact.
Yeah, because I think the best case scenario for any player, in my opinion, is a place where you go to with a good culture, good atmosphere, and you stay there for a while. So as a consequence, you're comfortable with it being yourself within that space. But realistically, for someone like Greg and lots of other people who've played football, having to introduce yourself to people for the first time, knowing that there's something about you which you're not sure these people engage with, whether that's good, bad, indifferent, or anything. Like, oh, this is such and such. And worse still, within football, it's a big community, but it's also quite a small one in the fact that as you arrive, someone will know someone who knows you. What happens if the first thing that they're saying is, well, he doesn't do initiations. He's too big on this. He keeps to himself. He doesn't really want to mix with the team. These are things which come with a bigger reasoning, but don't come with the explanation when you first arrive. So as a consequence, you know, you have this sort of image of you being portrayed, which just doesn't represent yourself. But realistically, you're not going to... Would anyone listening today, or anybody, say, in this studio, would you want to go up to a bunch of strangers and tell them everything about yourself to reveal exactly who you are? The chances are you probably wouldn't.
So you want to do it on your terms, don't you?
Exactly, yeah. But then you'd want to do it when you know the people there that have your best interests at heart. And it's very hard to figure out who that is. Because sometimes I've seen it myself where people do become vulnerable, and the bigger voices within the dressing room turn into a joke. Mm. And when something that you care about turns into a joke, like, it's such a tough response for those people, and I feel so, so bad for them.
Well, if you want to read any more about that story that we heard there or his experiences, former Premier League defender Greg Halford, there is a piece on the BBC Sport website with loads of information for Neurodiversity Celebration Week.